Svoje sporičine. Tuning into your body. Into the energetic heart, the center of the chest. The nexus of enlightenment in a human body. Using the hands at your heart to help you find and connect with the resonance of the heart center. And as you connect with the heart center, sit tall, the sense of dignity. Feeling, knowing in your bones that your purpose, the reason we're here, is to benefit others, to benefit ourselves, to contribute to great happiness and love. And the extended fingers of this mudra remind us, single-pointedly, this is why we're here. And as we step forward into that, there comes dignity. It's coupled with humility. It's very basic. Here to help. It's very humble, and yet it's very regal. See if you can feel those two together in the way that your hands are joined, coming to a point with the fingers, single-pointedly. Now moving out of the mind, moving deeper into the heart, to feeling, to that yearning. May our time together be of benefit, not only in this class this morning, our closing retreat, but may our time together here on earth be of benefit. Make that wish strongly in your being, in your citta. Good. Thank you very much. Welcome. I almost said happy Sunday. There's a lot I want to get through today. We'll see how it goes. But I'd like to start with some more. Okay, pop quiz. You just get a smile if you get it right. You don't get reprimanded or anything. Who's the author of the text I've been reading? Yay! Okay, great. So I thought we'd continue with the little Shantideva. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is well known for saying that anything he knows about compassion comes from this text. So here, I'm going to read from chapter 3, which is called Taking Hold of Bodhicitta. So in the first chapter, he's talking about why it's so great, right? Why this is even a virtue or an aspiration that to get excited about and to orientate our life around. Then he's making offerings to the Buddhas. It was so beautiful last night. I got some really fun ideas afterwards. And then he's the part we didn't read, where he's confessing. He's sort of that unmasking of like, oh, I don't need to posture anymore. Here's all the stuff I'm not proud about. And there's also, this follows a very traditional way that Tibetan Buddhists will prep before a meditation session. Refuge, bodhicitta, making offerings, confessing, and then rejoicing. And in the rejoicing, you actually practice feeling good about your own virtues, your own path, and also all the other beings who are doing amazing, wonderful things in the world. So it's a way of lifting the mind up. There's also something that's very sweet. I mean, it's funny. I hope it's true. It's very sweet, though. They say that if you rejoice in someone else's good deeds, I think this is hysterical, you get 10% of the good karma. So it's also a way of you're like racking in some good karma. And then there's some other things which we won't go into, where you think about the good qualities of your teacher and all the teachers, all the Buddhas, and you make a request, please stay and keep teaching, right? Please stick around. And that's both in the sense of, from the Mahayana perspective, please don't go to nirvana. Like, don't leave me here. Stay and help me. And also in the sense of, please, like regular teachers, please keep teaching. Dharma centers, please keep happening. Please may amazing innovative projects like Dharma Gates be here. We have to, in order to make these things happen, we have to want them to happen and feed into it, right? And there's also, I think this is very beautiful and it really uplifts me. The teachings on karma are very, very clear that the only reason that we are here in these extraordinary circumstances is because we've created the cause in the past. You're all here on generosity, right? It's only because you were generous in the past. You supported another practitioner. And now it's coming to fruition in your mind in that way. They also, and I think this is so beautiful, say that the only reason we're together is because we were together in the past. And they say it's very important for whoever's in the appearance, the position of the quote-unquote student, to do a really good job, because next time around it switches. Right? So we have to keep going like this. So I'm depending on you to teach me bodhicitta in the next life, right? So that's all very lovely, but here in this next chapter, taking hold of bodhicitta, it's a deepening, it's a dropping, right? Because I don't know where all of you are in your Dharma path, but with anything, and especially in Dharma in the beginning, you're like on fire. It's like so awesome, and you're like super gung-ho. And it's beautiful, that fire is so important, but it's also kind of surface, right? And so there's, the process is letting everything deepen and mature and develop. So it's like a coming back and deepening. And this chapter is a little bit like that to me. It sets that up. Okay. With joy I celebrate the virtue that relieves all beings from the sorrows of the states of loss, exulting in the happy states enjoyed by those who are yet suffering. I revel in the stores of virtue, cause of gaining the enlightened state, and celebrate the freedom won by living beings from the round of pain. That's a rejoicing verse, right? And in the Buddhahood of the protectors I delight, and in the grounds of realizations of the Bodhisattva heirs, their enlightened attitude, an ocean of great good, that seeks to place all beings in the state of bliss, in every action for the benefit of beings, such is my delight and joy. And so I join my hands and pray, the Buddhas who reside in every quarter, kindle now the Dharma's light for those who grope, bewildered, in the dark of pain. I join my hands, beseeching the enlightened ones who wish to pass into nirvana, do not leave us wandering in blindness, stay among us for unnumbered ages. So here we have the rejoicing and the request to stay and teach. Through these actions now performed and all the virtues I have gained, may all the pain of every living being be wholly scattered and destroyed. For all those ailing in the world, until their every sickness has been healed, may I myself become for them the doctor, nurse, the medicine itself. Raining down a flood of food and drink, may I dispel the ills of thirst and famine, and in the eons marked by scarcity and want, may I myself appear as drink and sustenance. For sentient beings poor and destitute, may I become a treasure ever plentiful, and lie before them closely in their reach, a varied source of all that they might need. My body thus, and all my goods besides, and all my merits gained and to be gained, I give them all and do not count the cost to bring about the benefit of beings. So here in this first part of the deepening, he's not just saying bodhicitta is so beautiful. He's saying, may I be the doctor, the nurse, and the medicine. He's stepping into the role. Okay, I want to do this now. He's taking it out of aspiration. May all beings be saved and happy, healthy and free. And I'm going to be the one to step up and work for it. Right? And as part of that, so actually, we didn't talk about this, but they break bodhicitta down into two aspects. First is the wish, the aspirational wish. May I become a Buddha to benefit beings? May I help beings? And then is active or engaged bodhicitta, where you say, okay, I'm going to do it. And you actually get up and do it. And then there's the how do you do it, and that's where the six paramitas come in. But also, in the how of doing it, you run up against your own attachment. And one of the things that they talk about a lot, I think because it's so provocative, is our attachment to our body. So there's all these aspirational verses of like, I give my body, you know? And you've all heard the story of when Shakyamuni Buddha was a bodhisattva. He gave his body to a hungry tigress so she could feed herself and her cubs, right? And these are supposed to be extremely confronting and make us uncomfortable because it's supposed to point back to like, let a tiger eat me? Like, really? To show how deeply attached we are to what? This heap of flesh that's going to die in not very long. And it's also supposed to be inspiring of like, well, I don't know if I could really give my body to the tiger, but how beautiful that someone else could. Like how lovely that there's beings out there that have that level of generosity and care, right? So I'll read a couple of these verses. They're supposed to be provocative. This body I have now resigned to serve the pleasure of all living beings. Let them ever kill, despise, and beat it, using it according to their wish. And although they treat it like a toy or make of it the butt of every mockery, my body has been given to them. Why should I make so much of it? But here he kind of circles back and is like, So let beings do to me whatever does not bring them injury. Which, so that's where we get a line of, no, I'm not offering myself to be the object of abuse, because that would bring the injury. If someone's abusing you, that's not good for them, right? So there's a line drawn there. So let beings do to me whatever does not bring them injury. Whatever they may think of me, let this not fail to bring them benefit. That's really radical. And then he fleshes it out. And if in my regard they have a thought of anger or respect, may these states always be the cause whereby their good and wishes are fulfilled. So usually, if someone has an angry thought to us, about us, the disrespectful thought or something, all we do is think about, oh my gosh, I wish they wouldn't think that, right? And he's saying, if someone has an angry thought towards me, somehow may that bring them benefit. Like, how beautiful, right? And if in my regard they have a thought of anger or respect, may these states always be the cause whereby their good and wishes are fulfilled. All those who slight me to my face or do to me some other evil, even if they blame or slander me, may they attain the fortune of enlightenment. May I be a guard for those who are protectorless, a guide for those who journey on the road. For those who wish to cross the water, may I be a boat, a raft, a bridge. May I be an isle for those who yearn for land, a lamp for those who long for light, for all who need a resting place, a bed. For those who need a servant, may I be their slave. May I be the wishing jewel, the vase of wealth, a word of power and of supreme healing. That refers to a mantra. May I be the tree of miracles, for every being the abundant cow. Just like the earth and space itself and all the other mighty elements, for boundless multitudes of beings, may I always be the ground of life, the source of varied sustenance. Thus, for everything that lives, as far as are the limits of the sky, may I be constantly their source of livelihood, until they pass beyond all sorrow. Just as the Buddhas of the past have brought forth the awakened mind, and in the precepts of the Bodhisattvas, step by step abode and trained, likewise, for the benefit of beings, I will bring to birth the awakened mind, and in those precepts, step by step, I will abide and train myself. I'm going to read those two verses again. They show up in some tantric texts. Just as all the Buddhas of the past have brought forth the awakened mind, and in the precepts of the Bodhisattvas, step by step, abode and trained, likewise, for the benefit of beings, I will bring to birth the awakened mind, and in those precepts, step by step, I will abide and train myself. Those who thus, with clear intelligence, take hold of the awakened mind with bright and lucid joy, that they may now increase what they have gained, should lift their hearts with praises such as these. So here what he's about to read, these are the things we can go to when our heart is heavy or when we need inspiration, which is kind of daily. Some of these are also in tantric liturgies that we recite 6 times a day, to be honest. Today my life has given fruit. This human state has now been well assumed. Today I take my birth in Buddha's line and have become the Buddha's child and heir. In every way, then, I will undertake activities befitting of such a rank, and I will do no act to mar or compromise this high and faultless lineage. I'll read it again. Today my life has given fruit. This human state has now been well assumed. Today I take my birth in Buddha's line and have become the Buddha's child and heir. In every way, then, I will undertake activities befitting of such a rank, and I will do no act to mar or compromise this high and faultless lineage. Lineage of what? The Bodhisattvas. For I am like a blind man who has found a precious gem inside a heap of dust. For so it is by some strange chance that bodhicitta has been born in me. This is the supreme draft of immortality that slays the lord of death, the slaughterer of beings. This rich, unfailing treasure mine to heal the poverty of wanderers. It is the sovereign remedy that perfectly allays all maladies. It is the tree that gives relief to those who wander wearily the paths of existence. It is the universal bridge that saves all wandering beings from the state of loss, the rising moon of the enlightened mind that soothes the sorrows born of the afflictions. How beautiful is that? The rising moon of the enlightened mind that soothes the sorrows born of the afflictions. It is the mighty sun that utterly dispels the misty ignorance of wandering beings, the creamy butter, rich and full, that's churned from milk of holy teaching. Living beings, wayfarers upon life's path, who wish to taste the riches of contentment, here before you is the supreme bliss. Here, O ceaseless travelers, is your fulfillment. And so today, within the sight of all protectors, I summon beings, calling them to Buddhahood. And until that state is reached, to every earthly joy, may gods and demigods and all the rest rejoice. Yeah.
A few sessions ago, you mentioned that there's a line between overgiving. So, with the excerpts that you read, how do you reconcile those two things?
Yeah. So, in order to be a benefit to others, you can't deplete or exhaust yourself. A doctor who stays up for 48 hours doing surgery, I don't want to be the 49th hour patient, right? Maybe she thinks she's doing such a great job. She's like, I'm not going to sleep. I'm just going to keep going. But come on, do not put me on that table, right? So that's the balance. If you really care about other people, you get your stuff together. And we're very, very lucky in this day and age to have psychotherapy as a resource. The skills are incredible there in terms of learning. What we talked about yesterday, a healthy ego, right? And almost all of us are really confused about it. And those verses where he says, may I be the doctor, the nurse, and the medicine. When we step into that role, it means we take the onus, the responsibility on ourselves to heal whatever's in us that could be keeping us from helping others and ourselves to the best of our ability, right? And we're all in the same boat. Some of us have gone through a lot of trauma, some of it in our families, intergenerational, societal, but it's on us, right? And because there's no actual difference between self and others, it's by healing our own stuff, finding our own strength, our own boundaries, our own ability to recognize when to say no and to have the ability to say no, to recognize when it's appropriate to say yes, and have the ability to give and move forward and say yes. Whichever way we're doing it, when we do it for ourselves, it's in service of others. And when we help others or say no to others, it's also in service of ourselves. So it's very beautiful that way. You get to work on it from both sides. One sec. Oh, and so, and we didn't get into this, but there's these other scriptures that are kind of, like, if you thought that was evocative, woo-hoo-hoo, it's the tip of the iceberg. These inspirational scriptures that are, they say things like, if someone betrays you deeply, someone that you loved and cared for and like gave your whole heart to, and they betray you, hold them as if they were your only child and they're sick, and your only wish is to help them and care for them. That's really beautiful until it happens, right? And then you're not like, oh, my sick baby. You're like, what? You know? And there's other verses that are, if someone, and this is so confronting in like this crazy era of like social media and stuff, but if someone like stands on a mountaintop and just like says all your bad qualities, true or not, right? That the response is, thank you, teacher. And so part of what the Bodhisattva path, when you start to get into it, when we move out of the aspirational, may all beings be Buddhas, and we look at like, well, what does that mean when the rubber hits the road? It's supposed to bring out, the way I think about it, is our own codependencies. That's a big part of it. And also just on a more basic level, our own attachment to our body or to our reputation or to what other, you know, like, well, I helped you, so I was expecting that you were going to be nice to me. You know, those kinds of attachments. And there's two, and every time those things happen, you get, if you're on the Bodhisattva path, you kind of come to a fork in the road. And the fork can be like, oh, you hurt me. Thank you, teacher. You know, and you kind of don't deal with the real muck that it brings up, which is you're crushed, you're in agony, you're all these things, right? That's not the Bodhisattva path. That's like fake Bodhisattvaness or something. What do they call it? I have some word in psychology. Spiritual bypassing. Yeah, it's definitely spiritual bypassing. What this path actually does, if you really follow it, it means that when those things happen, before you get to the point where you can say truly, thank you, you have to go through the hell of it and heal the inner relative parts. And that's why I was saying psychology is really useful for that. It's very helpful. And I think we're lucky to be alive in this day and age to have that as a tool and a paradigm. And to me, this is part of the brilliance of this Indo-Tibetan Bodhisattva lineage, is that it forces this stuff up, right? This is all the valid Dharma paths, all they're doing is forcing your stuff up. You think it's, oh, you're sitting so quietly and peacefully. It's all about churning up so that you have to see what's in there so that you can free it and move on. Right? The Bodhisattva path really lights a fire to it. And the tantric path is, it's a rocket ship to it. Okay, what else? Okay. Yeah.
You talked about the doctor, the 48 hours.
Yeah.
So if the doctor gives himself to be eaten by a tigress in the first hour, then...
Exactly. These are the questions, right? So usually the gauge is what's for the greatest good. Yeah, I mean, I hope that I hope the doctor doesn't give themselves to the tiger. I kind of hope no, but I'm like, I hope no one gives themselves to the tiger. But then I'm like, I don't want the tiger to be hungry. But, so that's the gauge. What's the greatest good? But you are included in that. What's the greatest good for me too? And maybe that means stepping away or staying home and resting or not going to the Dharma teaching or going to the Dharma teaching, right? But ultimately, the what's the greatest good, that knowing arises spontaneously and it is perfectly appropriate and you don't need to weigh it out. And that's the fruit of it. That's the whole of it. But until then, we just do our best. And the beautiful, beautiful thing about the Bodhisattva path, but this, you could say this about all the Dharma paths, is that whatever arises becomes not only grist for the mill, but becomes the fuel for the fire. It becomes the thing that makes the bodhicitta burn brighter, right? If someone slanders you, did I read it yesterday? I don't know. I read a lot of Dharma on my own, so I never remember what I talked about or read in here versus what I'm reading in the cabin. It said that a bodhisattva's path, bodhisattva's practice gets stronger when bad things happen to them. Oh, it was in Shantideva. I don't know if you remember. It's at the end of the first or second chapter. And the reason they say a bodhisattva's practice gets stronger when bad things happen to them is because they're using the perceived obstacle to increase their own compassion, to increase their capacity to see clearly, to say, no, I'm not giving myself to the tiger here. That's not the best way. Because sometimes there's just suffering. Sometimes tigers go hungry. And I wish it weren't so, and it breaks my heart open. But this is the reality. And I, as a bodhisattva, can bear witness to suffering without falling apart, and I know when to give myself and when not to give myself. Good. Yeah.
So with nature documentaries and all those things, I would always cry when the middle lion kills the gazelle or the lion starts to death and all those things. But with you hoping that, you know, the lion doesn't starve, I assume that people would also feel sad for the food the lion kills to survive. And so what is that balance there? Because I find I process that a lot healthier now, or when I'm watching, I still prefer not to see it. But I find it very beautiful in, you know, seeing it in nature when it's necessary. Yeah. Unnecessary, of course, very different. Different external variables that wouldn't come into play last.
Yeah, you just bear witness to it all and deal with what comes up inside of you. That's how we do it. You just face what's there and do it nicely with all these teachings of suffering and interdependence and impermanence and your heart breaking open and the wish that I can't, this is how it is, a lion's got to kill a gazelle, the gazelle has to die, like, you know. It's sad. Yeah, but also like that, just facing it. Okay, so I wanna scope out a little bit and keep building the context of where Vajrayana is in the Indo-Tibetan traditions and how it came to Tibet. So Tibet was like obsessed with India. Tibet had a lot of cool stuff going on later, But at the time when the teachings are coming from India to Tibet, India is a very sophisticated culture. And Tibet's cut off up in the snowlands. So they invite these very erudite scholars to come to Tibet to share the teachings. And because they have such a high respect for India, they just copy everything just as it is, right? And they make these massive translation, they're literally like translation factories where they're just translating the text. And one of the teachers who brought Indian Buddhism, Mahayana, into Tibet, his name's Atisha, is an incredible, incredible scholar and practitioner. And one of the things that he's known for doing is there's just this vast array of teachings. We've got early Buddhist texts and commentaries. We've got Mahayana scriptures that are being revealed through people's visualizations and coming up from nagas and lakes and mountains and all these wonderful things. We've got commentaries on those. Tantra is starting to come around, and it's just a lot, and no one quite knows where to start with it. And so Atisha takes everything and puts it into steps. He's like, okay, start with suffering, impermanence, birth, death, all this, and then you move into wanting to benefit beings and bodhicitta, and then we move into tantra, like that. And so it's called lam rim in Tibetan, meaning steps of the path, stages of emotional, psychological, spiritual development for a human being, right? In the same way, we don't start with calculus. You have to just learn the numbers, and then you learn addition, and then you're like, subtraction just keeps getting crazier and crazier, right? Multiplication, division, what, you know? It's like that. And so Tantra's at the end of it, where you already have these foundations of impermanence and suffering and refuge, and then bodhicitta and running up against, do I give myself to the tiger? What do I do? Where's my own boundaries? How do I help? Like that. Then, in the 8th century, and I mentioned him on the first Friday night, and this is the mantra that was playing today. There's a Indian scholar who also, he also studied at this very famous Indian university called Nalanda. His name was Padmasambhava. He's also known as Guru Rinpoche. And he really brought Tantra as we know it to Tibet. And he also introduced what are called the Dzogchen teachings. And so in Tibetan Buddhism, there's actually methods that are considered, I don't quite mean this word, but I also kind of mean this word, higher than Vajrayana. And these are Mahamudra, and then Dzogchen would be the pinnacle. And these methods are almost no method. And they skirt up against Zen in this way, where it's just drop the whole thing, drop the concepts, drop all of it, just sit and look at what? Naked awareness. But it's considered, it's so direct and so simple that it's very hard to get there. And so in the Tibetan system, they're like, you got to do all this other stuff first to prepare you, to purify your karma, to get the merit, to train your mind and body in order to just be with what is without doing anything and without exerting any effort. And the way that the world is explained or revealed in Dzogchen teachings is different. It's a very, very radical, extraordinarily beautiful worldview and way of, and it's like the world and the and your own awareness. They say that it is empty, of course, luminous. It is instinctively knowing, spontaneously, naturally aware, no effort. It is primordially pure, impossible of being stained. And it is inseparable from this utterly appropriate, spontaneous, compassionate activity. All wrapped up like that. And Dzogchen is actually called Atta Yoga, meaning like not yoga, opposite of yoga. And yoga refers to the Vajrayana. So it's also a bit of a response and saying like, you guys are getting so, you got so carried away with the methods that like, it's not even about that. Like, wake up, it's this other thing. Yeah, so I just wanted you to know there's another path. But usually they're done a little bit together, right? We do Vajrayana practices, we do Dzogchen practices, we're doing Bodhisattva practices, we're doing mindfulness practices, we're doing shamatha, basic sitting practices. Like all of this is happening. You're using whichever ones you need in response to your world, to what's happening, like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I just like want to like reconcile all these different paths. I think the part of my mind that wants to put everything together and make sense of everything is struggling, and as maybe it should, and I am. You know, could try to not put it together, but like, I wonder if you can say a word about reconciling all these things. And some wise person, I think, in this room said to me, to small mind, it doesn't make sense, to big mind, it's all part of the same thing.
Well, I think for me, a useful way to recognize it is to think of it as developmental or progressive stages of spiritual development. But if you want it all to fit nicely together, it doesn't. It's not how it works. And you have to hold that. You know? Like, ego wants, and this was in my notes for yesterday, I just didn't get to it. What ego wants really, really, and this is all of us all the time, is we want to be like, okay, this is here. And this is blue and it's here, green, whatever. And the reason ego likes to do that is because it says, if that's there, I'm here. If that exists over there, then I know I exist over here. And that's all ego's doing all the time. It's like absolutely freaking out on high alert, going, do I exist? And from the outside, seemingly from the outside, wisdom is pushing up, pushing in all the time. All the time. And ego, and that's why ego has to constantly be like that. Because it senses wisdom that says it's not like that. Right?
There's moments where wisdom appears to be like an enemy.
Oh my God, totally.
It's kind of freaky.
Absolutely. 100%. My whole life is me fighting wisdom. Yeah. That's why the Mahayana, we can, and by extension Vajrayana and then Dzogchen pulls it out of the water, is characterized by openness, where we're like, not this and that, just more open, more fluid. And what does that mean? It's not going to make sense. You're not going to be able to pin it down. Wisdom can't be pinned down. It doesn't, it's not a puzzle. And this is what we all, this is, the path exists the way it exists because we intuitively, instinctively think, well, if I just put the puzzle together, right? And we see that in all aspects of our lives. If I just finish my degree, if I just get the job and the partner and the house or the 100,000 followers or like whatever it is, you know, there's something in us that really believes I can hack it, I can do it. Seriously. Exactly. I can hack it. Neither exists, neither work. Thank God you're laughing, not crying.
It's like the same thing, it sucks. It's like, oh God, really? Okay.
Well, you know what's so funny about it? We're like, oh, this totally sucks, because what's its opposite? Enlightenment, which doesn't suck. Right? Yeah. We're going to put it here. Yeah, no, we got to do it.
So Mahayana is kind of the umbrella, the lineage from which Vajrayana, Mahamudra, and Dzogchen developed, kind of in that sequence.
Well, caveat there. Yeah. I mean, Mahayana worldview, everything's happening at once. It's all been happening together. It's just being, beings are just waking up to it at a time when.
So is that the historical evolution?
Historically, it's happening like that,
yeah.
But not from inside the traditions. We don't think of it that way.
Yeah.
But we're smart, we can hold both. Yeah. Sorry, was that your question?
Well, yeah, like in terms of when they appeared in texts. Like.
Yeah, yes, like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can put it down.
Okay, we can. So we know where this is.
Yeah.
Oh, thank God. Okay. Someone else had a question. Yeah.
I have a question about the concept of this perfect world. Like you're just talking about a lineage that like everything is already like in alignment as it should be. And I'm curious how to reconcile that teaching with the world as it is and like our alignment.
Yeah. If we have more time, I could give you the philosophical thing, which I think you'd resonate with. But for now, I want to keep it in the metaphor of how do you reconcile the fact that the world is flat? Don't tell me it's not flat. It is totally flat. When I drive to New York City today, I'm not going to perceive myself going on a curve. When I fly to Asia in a couple months, I'm not going to perceive myself rounding a globe, right? How do you reconcile that with the fact that we know it's round and that it's a rock spinning in space around a giant fireball, right? All these things can exist validly at once. We do perceive suffering. There is suffering. There is shit we have got to change and do stuff about. And these older generations, messed it up, right? Seriously. That is true. And depending on the clarity of one's vision, you could see it as perfectly already bloomed and pure at the same time. But it doesn't mean you don't keep fighting or addressing what appears as flat, what appears as suffering. Philosophically, we could talk about it as relative or ultimate truth, but I don't want to get into it, that one today. Okay, so no one's seen these or heard these yet. I haven't showed them to any of my translator friends or my teachers. So, you know, we'll see. Caveat, maybe. I don't think they're wrong. But I wanted to share some Dzogchen refuge prayer that I just translated and a Dzogchen bodhicitta prayer that I just translated. Because they also elucidate some tantric points and systems and terminology that we haven't touched on that I wanted to introduce. Okay, so before I until I reach the heart of enlightenment, I take refuge in the essence of the three jewels, the sugatas and the three roots. I'm going to explain all this. I take refuge in bodhicitta, the nature of the nadis, prana, and bindu. I take refuge in the mandala, its essence, nature, and spontaneously responsive compassion. So I, by my translation, what I think that this prayer, you know, oh, we don't have that one up. Here we go. Typically, refuge objects, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We all know this, right? The three jewels. So here, Buddha, I take refuge in the three jewels. Sugata is a Sanskrit word. It means, usually it's translated as one gone to bliss, but it's like one who's done well, one who's reached the other side, reached the goal. So he's saying, I take refuge in the ones who... Why is this happening to me? I take refuge... It's like loose or something? Oh, there we go. I take refuge in the ones who have done it. Which makes sense, right? We don't want to take refuge in the ones that are trying to figure it out. Take refuge in the ones that did it. And then I take refuge in the three roots. This is an important tantric concept. What are the three roots? The three roots are the lama, the teacher, the yidam, which is a Sanskrit word for your tantric deity. The tantric Buddha that you're practicing with is called your yidam. I take refuge in the lama, the yidam, and the dakini. What's the dakini? The dakini is the feminine form of enlightenment, the feminine form of wisdom. And dakinis are swift, they are fast, they are hysterical, they have a really great sense of humor, of like everything's kind of cosmically funny, and they are brutal. They suffer no fools. They're often depicted with a chop knife. They will chop your head off. They are not scared to slice you, to wake you up, to bring you to benefit. So versus like, I don't know, like when I was a kid and I had like a splinter or something, and you know, sometimes you have to like cut your finger to get the splinter out. Like my mom couldn't do it. She couldn't bear the thought of me like being cut for a second or like getting a shot, you know? She just couldn't handle it. But Dakini's like, get over here, you know, because it's for your own good. So these three things show some really important aspects of Tantrayana or Vajrayana, which we haven't even talked about yet. Well, let's just check out the order of that. Lama, Yidam, Dakini. Who comes first in the order? Lama. Weird. I thought the Yidam was going to come first. No. Here in this methodology, you know how yesterday I was saying that, I was saying that in a private conversation. When you are opening yourself up to this imagined Buddha, I was saying that's a very easy thing to open yourself up to. It's imagined, they're Buddha, they're all love and just there for you, right? Great. How about opening yourself up to a human being who has flaws and all the rest? Much harder, much more confronting, right? So part of the tantric methodology is to take the living human being that's harder to open up to and kind of meld it with the beautiful, imagined, pure Buddha, right? So it requires a greater openness. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is, who is teaching us the Dharma? For most of us, it's a human being. Okay, some of us, not me, are having visions, direct visions of Buddhas that come and sit down or stand, I think they stand, in front of you and give you teachings like that. But most people, and even when that happens, most of the time people are getting their teachings from a human being. So Tantra starts to elevate the teacher in that way, to say like, yeah. So anyway, so there's this incredible emphasis on devotion, and it's been wildly misunderstood, and it at times has been wildly abused. But, and there's no, it is a complete misunderstanding that you do everything the teacher says and you're their slave and give me a break. No, you are developing, you're trying to become a Buddha, an awakened person. You're not trying to become subservient and listening to someone tell you exactly what to do and what's right and wrong. Come on. No. But one way that you can frame early Buddhism, Mahayana, and Tantra is that early Buddhism, what we're developing is love. Loving kindness, metta. And we never give that up. Every tantric text, whether it's state that I've seen, whether it's stated or not, and usually it's fleshed out, but sometimes it's implied, we start with developing not only bodhicitta, but metta and the four immeasurables. These are the highest, most advanced practices, and that's where we start. You steep in it. You never give it up. I feel like crying. You never give it up. This is what we learn in our foundational Buddhism. You have to, the deeper you develop it, oh my God, you go so fast in the other ways. Then when we get into Mahayana in the Indo-Tibetan traditions, it's just all about compassion. So metta, love, is may you be happy. And compassion is, how can I help you? How can I take away your pain? Different level of engagement, right? And it's very sobering. Because in order for me to want to take away your pain, I have to acknowledge your pain. I have to be able to hold it. And I have to develop the wisdom to know how to respond appropriately. This is no easy matter. So we have love or loving kindness, we have compassion, and then Tantra moves it into devotion. And don't think it's some blind devotion to some guru or something. It's not that. It's devotion to the highest aspect of your own mind, your own awakened nature. That's what you've become, that's what you're developing devotion towards. But that's so vague. What does that even mean? My own awakened nature. I don't know how to touch that. But I love my teacher. Why? Because they're teaching me the Dharma, and the Dharma makes me happy. It makes my life better, right? And I love the Buddhas. Why? Because they've taught the Dharma, and they're inspiring me. And I feel inspired by the possibility of the fulfillment of these qualities, these big, beautiful qualities, aspects of wisdom and love. And it's not a path for everyone. It's so many people, it's way too confronting. And that's fine. No big deal. It's so not a big deal, whichever thing you're resonating with at any given moment. Do not reify it. All you're doing is, that's over here, and then so I'm over here. This one's me, and that one's them, and I'm here. Drop it. It's no big deal. You just go with whatever you're interested in at any moment. Really open, really spacious about it. And for me, I don't know why, but my whole kind of Dharma path and his, like, trajectory so far is I've just been really close to my teachers. And many of my friends, very nice Dharma practitioners, very, very nice, doing very nicely, they're just like, I have no interest in what you're doing. Like, I don't want to be that close to a teacher. And when I first heard it, I was just like, really? Like, I didn't even know there was something like confronting about it. It's just some, it's like baked into me. And it's just not everyone's path. But that is that's part of the methodology of Tantra, traditionally. And I think that's gonna maybe change, I don't know. I don't know if it has to, like, certainly in the West, it's tricky with the, like, Lama thing, and the guru thing, we're still figuring that out. But devotion, that quality of just like I am devoted to enlightenment, that's not dependent on a Lama. That's not dependent on a Buddha. Like, you can, that's what, so I don't know. What's so special about devotion? It's just more open, it's bigger. Loving kindness, compassion, devotion. Like that. And then this other aspect of Tantrayana is the feminine, in the swiftness and the cuttingness, the magicalness of it. And that's really exemplified by the dakinis. Okay, so that's that first line of the prayer. I go for refuge to the essence of the three jewels, those thus gone, the Lama, the Edom, and the dakini. Dakinis. What this first line in my reading also points to is the first level of the most complete of the tantric paths, and it's usually translated as the generation stage. And this is where you're learning, we talked about this last night, what they call divine pride. You're practicing identifying with the flower, the Buddha. What would it be like if these qualities were already born in me? And in that, you're running up against the beliefs that we hold that the world is flat, meaning that I exist a certain way. I'm a human, I'm not a Buddha yet. It's like this. And so we practice embodying the Buddha, our yidams, in order to start to dissolve that. That's called the generation stage. Second line of this prayer. I take refuge in bodhicitta. We know what that means, right? The nature of the nadis, prana, and bindu. All right, what do those weird, fancy Sanskrit words mean? Nadis are the subtle energetic channels that run through the bodies. The Chinese correlate would be like the meridians. You can't see them. We can't measure them. But you got a headache, they stick a needle in a certain particular one and your headache goes away. Prana is the energy that moves through these channels. It's our life force. So you can think of it as chi. And then the bindu is the most subtle essence of the mind. That is the kind of the extremely subtle physical basis for realization. So nadis, prana, and bindu. And so there's different ways to understand bodhicitta. We've been talking about it as the wish to achieve enlightenment, or the mind, heart-mind of awakening. But it also refers to the subtle substances in our energetic body that give rise to realization or enlightenment. It's also defined, especially in Dzogchen, as the realization of the way things are. It's called bodhicitta. So these words have many, many layers, many, many meanings, which is partly why it's done on purpose, so that you can't understand the prayers of the text without explanation from a teacher. And it's not about the explanation. It's about the wisdom that is being carried in their words, not my words, by the way, but in the words of realized beings when they explain it. That's what's happening. There's a living, it's like someone's passing you a flame or a gem like that. That's why it's secret, that's why it's coded, so that it doesn't die on the page. It stays alive through the teacher's blessing, which is what? Just their practice. It's just their practice. So here, I take refuge in bodhicitta, the nature of the nadis, prana, and bindu. Again, in my reading, this refers to what we call completion stage yoga or completion stage tantra practice. And in the completion stage tantra practice, you're already really good. You're really well versed and practiced with holding yourself as a Buddha, but not in the sense that you're posturing, but that you've really started to touch and feel the seed of enlightenment within yourself. And when that's stable, then you start to work with the subtle energies of the body to start to really transform things. You're starting to... I once had an interview with he's called the Ganden Tripa, the top lama in the Geluk lineage. And he said the most difficult stains to get out are the subtle stains. Mostly we're just dealing with big, big stuff. We're just like going like this. But that mustard stain that's been on your white shirt for 3 years, that's very difficult to get out, very subtle. And that's what the completion stage practices are getting out, these very subtle stains that are keeping us from making full contact with reality as it is uninterruptedly all the time. Okay. And then here, this last line, I take refuge in the mandala, this essence, nature, and spontaneously responsive compassion. Again, in my reading, this refers to Dzogchen. Because this is the classic, first of all, this is from a Dzogchen text and teaching that actually my teacher at 11 o'clock there's really beautiful Dzogchen teachings. And these prayers are from these teachings that I've been taking. With Dzogchen, we talk about the essence, which I already talked about, emptiness, the nature, which is this knowing and luminosity, and this spontaneously responsive compassion. And so here we're talking about the mandala, meaning the way this view of the world as existing in this empty, luminous, spontaneously arising, compassionate way. And so this is a nice, I think, formulation of the path, right? Of the tantric path. Generation, completion, stage yoga, and then Ati Yoga, beyond yoga, Dzogchen. Good, so mostly I just wanted to introduce those concepts to you so that you heard them. And then here's a Dzogchen Bodhicitta prayer. So these last two lines of this classic refuge formulation are a bodhicitta prayer, right? By the merit of giving and the rest, may I achieve Buddhahood for the benefit of beings. Very, very basic bodhicitta. And here's a more elaborate bodhicitta. Ho, mesmerized by the variety of phenomenal appearances, deceptive like the moon's reflection in water, beings wander in samsara like sheep tied together, each inevitably following the other, so that they may rest in the basic space of luminous self-awareness. I awaken bodhicitta through the four immeasurables. I'm going to read it again. Ho, mesmerized by the variety of phenomenal appearances, deceptive like the moon's reflection in water, beings wander in samsara like sheep tied together, each inevitably following the other, so that they may rest in the basic space of luminous self-awareness. I awaken bodhicitta through the four immeasurables. So beautiful, right? But here we are, highest level of yoga of Buddhist philosophy, basic space of luminous self-awareness. That points to, at least in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, peak at tippity top of the mountain. And what's it also tied to? Four immeasurables, the foundation. It's never being let go, always being incorporated, celebrated, continuously deepened and practiced. So here it's saying, practice the four immeasurables, and through the four immeasurables, let bodhicitta arise and strengthen. And through that, let's work to get beings out of samsara. Why are beings in samsara? Because in the same way that the moon is reflected in water, beings, ourselves, we are looking at the reflection of the moon, and we are convinced that that is the moon, and we are freaking out. Oh my God, the moon is like that. Oh my God, it's getting smaller. Oh my God, it's not here on time. Oh, it's exactly like that. Oh, you think the moon's like that? Well, I'm looking at it, and I'm going to tell you it's like that. We're going nutso, and it's not even the moon. It's just an appearance. It's an illusion. And don't then say, oh, that's the illusion, but that's the moon. That's also not it. You can't point to anything. That's what it's all about. Whenever we're like, oh, I got it. Silly me. Not that. You're still off. Okay? So because beings, and this is samsara, this is ignorance. The ignorance is that we're obsessed with the reflection and we don't even know it's a reflection. But that's only the first part of the problem. best first part is, oh my God, it's a reflection. And then you start to look at the moon. And then you go, you figure the whole moon out, right? But you're still not there because you're still on a moon. The point is the moon has to dissolve. The moon itself has to dissolve. But because we're obsessed with the reflection, we haven't even gotten to the moon. We are just compulsively circling samsara. And so this, I don't know. I read this in the dictionary, so take it with a grain of salt. But this Tibetan points to sheep tied together. Apparently, they tie, these herders, tie these sheep together in one long line. You know, like little kids when they hold their little rope. And so each sheep has to follow the other. But the point is just that because we're obsessed with the reflection, and then if you're lucky, the moon itself, you just have to keep going through samsara because you're missing the fact that A, it's a reflection, B, there's no even moon there reflecting it. That's what ties you round and round. Yeah, like that. Okay, so should we take a 10-minute break? Okay. We will see you back here in 10 minutes.
Can you see where Nick is? You can stop the recording. David.
Oh, that is long.
Can I show you my cool t-shirt?
Yeah.
It's a Tara Mandala.
Really?
Yeah. Whoa.
Oh my God, it's so beautiful.
Yeah. There was this llama, he was coming around doing sand paintings.
This and the colors are different.
No, why?
Because like you mentioned there was green.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. So there's two different systems of this. Well, so first of all.
Hello, everybody.
So no. It's very powerful if any time you're sitting or touching in with awareness, even if you're just having a mindful moment of being aware of the warmth of the sun on your skin, to recall bodhicitta and to recall it not just in your mind, but from your heart. May this deed, whatever it is, be of vast benefit. Good, thank you. So I wanted to give you all a little run of show of how the rest of the morning is going to go. So we are going to wrap up our teaching session at 11:20. And then we're going to talk about stuff. And you'll have the opportunity to fill out. Aaron's going to talk about Dharma Gates and a little more about the mission. You're going to hear a little more about Barry. And just about the center. And you'll have the opportunity to fill out a survey for Dharma Gates, which is a real act of generosity. When you're on the organizing side of things, it's hard to kind of over... It's so helpful when people actually say what you think, what you feel. When you're on the other side, it seems like it's like not such a big deal. But when you're on the organizer, it's like the whole reason you're doing everything, right, is to have it resonate with people. So getting that feedback it's such a beautiful gesture. So you'll have the opportunity to do that. And we'll wrap up with a group picture before lunch. And I wanted to, before we're going to weave back into Dharma and then we're going to close things out, with a dedication, of course. But before we get back into the Dharma and dedication, I just wanted to tell you a little bit about my offerings and what I do and how you can find me. So mostly I'm teaching retreats, and I'm working one-on-one with individuals. And it's sort of like, if you want to learn more about Buddhist philosophy and the way that I've been trained, but mostly what I'm interested in is making connections with human beings and looking at ways to bring the Dharma into individuals' lives that are a good match for them and what's ever happening with them. And it's primarily because that's the way I've been trained and mentored with my teachers thus far. So that's like that. So if you ever want to connect, and it's not like some coaching thing where you like sign up for 10 sessions or something. We just meet when and if you want, kind of thing, you know. You can find me on my website. And I have a new project in New York City. It's called Dharma Friends, and it meets at Tibet House. And it's a once a month by donation community gathering where we do Dharma, like where I can actually talk the way I've been speaking about here, like capital B Buddhist Dharma, and meditation. So we can sit together as human beings in a room. And then we also bring in embodiment and art. And every month there's a special guest. So like this month, my friend Rob is going to play classical viola. Last month, we had this amazing poet read her Rumi translations, which are super beautiful, and she sung them. So that's if you're in the New York City area, if you're ever passing through, that's a really nice way to stay connected. And in the fall, this is not up on my website yet, but I recently took a training out of Stanford University called Compassion Cultivation Training. And it's a course that I had taken 10 years ago. It's an 8-week course. And it basically takes one of the traditional Tibetan ways to train in and develop compassion. It takes one of those methodologies and delivers it in a very open, secular, friendly way over 8 weeks. And it also brings in a lot of neuroscience and psychology. And in the fall, I will be teaching that course in its entirety for the first time as part of my practicum in order to be certified to teach it. And so because it's a practicum teaching, I'll be teaching it at a lower cost than I will be in the winter. And so if that's something you're interested in, there'll be a place to sign up on the website because it'll be capped. at 20 people, so you can get on that list so that if you're interested in taking it at the reduced rate, you can do that. Yeah, I think that's it about me and how to find me and all of that. Do you have any questions on any of that? No? Okay, good. Yeah.
Where is the Tibet House?
Oh, so the Tibet House is in New York City, 15th Street. It's on 15th Street. It's between 5th and 6th. I always get 15th and 17th Street confused. I don't know why. There's this a lot of Dharma on 15th and 17th Street. I'm sure I'm like, some Dakini blessed these three little blocks, because there's just a strange amount of Dharma, but that's what it is. And Tibet House is the cultural center of the Dalai Lama. So obviously Tibetan culture has been, it's under, you know, it's in danger of going extinct because they've lost their land and all these things. So it's very important. It was very important for the Dalai Lama to have places where Tibetan culture, as well as Tibetan Buddhism, was preserved. So there's many Tibet houses all over the world. This is the one in USA. And it's a huge, amazing gallery space. It's just huge. And right now the walls are filled with these beautiful, beautiful, like, I don't know, how tall are they? Like 20 feet, yeah, 30 feet? Tall. Images from this very ancient remote temple in Ladakh. And for me, it's a really big deal that they've offered to host Dharma Friends there, because it's very, very hard to find a place to do in-person gatherings, especially in the city. There's not many places, and they tend to be extraordinarily expensive or just booked up. And so it's a big deal that Tibet House is hosting us. Right now, because it's a new project, there's a big push to get people to actually show up, because that's the thing that's going to encourage them to keep hosting us. Otherwise, we're in danger of Dharma becoming, you have to pay $35, $45 just to get in the door, right? And it's a big deal that Tibet House is letting this be on a sliding scale. Because projects like that, projects like Dharma Gates, these are radical in this time. And if you want donation-based Dharma to exist, you got to support it. You got to show up and put in what you can in whatever ways you can. That doesn't necessarily mean monetarily, but it means showing up so that this stuff lives on, right? Otherwise, it's just going to be another commodity, and you're all going to have to go become lawyers in order to afford the Dharma. It's tricky. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
Did you say your course is online?
The compassion course will be online. Yeah. Yeah? Okay. So, in honor of Guru Rinpoche, it's not in here, Padmasambhava, who brought a really kind of established tantra in Tibet, as well as Dzogchen, I thought I'd share a very beautiful, and we can put these in the resources, 7-line prayer to Guru Rinpoche. And I'd also thought I'd share his mantra, which has been playing. Maybe you can write it up. It's here. That's A-H.
Great.
And then one thing I wanted to say about mantras. So Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha. It's like an invocation to Tara. It's a praise to Tara. And mantras can be translated. Like there are, I mean, they're in Sanskrit, so there's a correlation. But it's not, one of the main characteristics of Vajrayana, if you try to figure everything out, the Vajrayana system is gonna like slap you, because it's not that. You can't nail it down. Figuring it out is like, it's the reflection. No, it's the moon. And it's pointing to something that's not there, can't be pointed to. So the most important qualities for Vajrayana is this openness, this quality of devotion. Don't need to confuse it with devotion to the Lama, but it's that open-hearted devotion and being open to going with the flow. being open and comfortable with not understanding it. And Vajrayana, there's layers and layers and layers of meaning and experience and realization and symbolism, and you can't get them all, and you certainly can't get them all at the beginning. You have to be comfortable swimming and going underwater and trying to get out. That's the path, right? Thanks. But when you the Tara mantra, it's both a praise, but it's really an invocation. You're calling Tara. Right? Ture is the invocative form of the word Tara. Tara. Ture is the Sanskrit to invoke her, to call her. And you're saying, Tara, O Tara, swift Tara, Tara. You're calling on her swiftness. Om in Vajrayana references the body, purifying the body. This gets purified. I'm going to throw out some nerdy terms, but I'm not going to explain them. Nasty, nasty trick. This correlates to their nirmanakaya. I know, so tricky. It's for the three of you that know what it means. Ah correlates to sambhogakaya. It means it's speech, but it has to do with the energies of the body. So om we think of at the forehead and white in the body. Ah, at the throat, speech. But speech means energy, prana. Hum is at the heart, and it's the mind. Mind, heart. Hum being the last one. Om, ah, hum. The realized form of body, speech, and mind. Hum is Dharmakaya. Benza is how the Tibetans say Vajra. Diamond. Guru. Lama, teacher. Pema is how the Tibetans say Padma, lotus. So remember we did Om Mani Padme Hum. Mani, jewel. Padma, lotus. Jewel being compassion, lotus being wisdom. So here we have Pema. We're referencing the wisdom here. So Om Ah Vajra Guru Pema Siddhi. Siddhi is the accomplishments, the realizations that we gain through our meditative practice. The fruit. Hung. So you'll also see this as Om Ah Vajra Guru Pema Siddhi Hung or Om Ah Benza Guru Pema Siddhi Hung. I went with Benza because that's the Tibetan pronunciation, is what's on the recordings. So one of the reasons that I wanted to introduce this mantra is not only in reverence and acknowledgement and admiration for Padmasambhava, whose other name is Guru Rinpoche, for bringing or establishing, rather, Tantra in Tibet, and also Dzogchen, which is the lineage I'm currently steeped in. But because my teacher recently gave a talk around Tibetan New Year, Lunar New Year, happened in February, and apparently in the 8th century, there were these prophecies that in the year 2030, the earth was going to be in very large danger from a really big catastrophe. And the prophecy said that it was beginning in this year, 2024, that we could start making efforts to avert it. I don't know, but the lamas are all talking about this. And they have recommended this mantra as one of the ways to help take the spark out of that potential catastrophe. So I thought it'd be nice to share the mantra. And a note on these mantras, we already talked about Om Mani Padme Hum and Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha as being these SOS mantras for compassion. When we're really unraveled, we can go to them to soothe us. There are times when you can be so dysregulated that it's really easy to say a mantra, right? Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. There's times where you can be so dysregulated you can't even do that. So you just put on the chant, right? So it's very good to have the whole range of practices. Maybe one day you'll get permission to do the tantric practice to Chenrezig or Tara, which is way more complicated than the mantra. So there's a continuum. But it's very good to have a whole continuum, wherever your continuum starts. If it starts at tantric sadhana practice and it goes all the way to a recording of David Paimel singing the mantra, or if it just starts at the mantra and goes to recording, it's good to have something that you can do when you can't do anything. And putting on the chants is really, really nice. And what you might find, what I find, is the chant itself, it does help. And it's thought to purify the space. So sometimes we feel wackadoo because the energies in the space are wackadoo. And the chanting, the mantra, by the power of the mantra is thought to purify that. And then because everything's interdependent, we become soft and purified with it as well. But sometimes it comes on and I'm just like, I'm just crying, I can't do anything. And then after a while, like suddenly I'm singing, you know? And then before I know it, I'm just like making tea and it's like the whole thing's gone. So like that. Okay, so I'll just read you these seven lines. I think they're very beautiful. So in the Tibetan tradition, I don't know if this is in the East Asian traditions or not, but the Dharma texts are considered extremely precious. And so they're wrapped in something precious. You don't just throw them in your bag along with your journal and your tea and stuff's gonna get all over it. So you wrap it in something. It doesn't have to be like a fancy silk brocade. It can just be like a nice scarf or a piece of cloth or something. So that's traditional, and we don't put them on the floor. Also as a sign of respect, because the idea is if we follow these texts nicely, you reach enlightenment. So it's a big deal. Also, I mentioned that, sorry, they're just starting, so I wanted to, that I've been taking these Dzogchen classes. And the Lama who's teaching them is in Nepal, and so we're all on Zoom. And both the Lama and the translator mentioned something that I think is important in the Zoom era, is that traditionally when you're at a teaching, you're doing what you all are doing right now. You're sitting up well, you're attentive, like you're here to learn the thing. You're not like also checking your phone or reading a book or doing thing. You're like, you're there, right? And we have to be careful as the teachings become more accessible, namely over Zoom, that you're not just playing a precious Dharma teaching and then you go to make a peanut butter and jelly and you're doing this and you're doing that. Meanwhile, there is a Lama sitting there teaching and you're just acting like, you know, we're just totally taking it for granted, right? Now, I do think there's a difference potentially, we can make the difference or not, between a podcast or pre-recorded. And I don't think there's anything wrong with like listening to something like that while you're doing your daily stuff. But even then, we have to acknowledge, if you're listening to a Dharma talk, that the best, even if it's a pre-recorded podcast, the best way to do it is to sit down and, you know, really pay attention and do it, is if you're face-to-face. But at the very least, if someone's teaching live, it's to our advantage to act like we're in the room with them and to show. It's not like respect for the human being, although that's like kind of part of it, but it's respect for the Dharma, right? Because if you like the Dharma, how do you think you're going to create the causes to keep learning it? Especially showing up, you know, feeding into it like that. So I'm just passing that along. And we have to be very gentle too. Like, we also don't want to then be like, oh, now I know how it's right. And you see someone else making the peanut butter and jelly or doing whatever. But we don't think like, oh my God, they're totally doing it wrong. Let me go reprimand them in the tea break. Ugh, the amount of times senior Dharma practitioners come and reprimand people. Give me a break. No. We'd be generous and open, but we also, as you all grow up in the Dharma and you start to learn more, we want to gently help people, but don't go around correcting people and telling them how to do it, especially if the person in the front of the room isn't saying anything. Maybe that's exactly when you help the person, but maybe the person in the front of the room is not saying anything because they think it's in the best interest of the person not to, you know? So we hold everything very, very lightly, and we just do our best to be as open and kind and non-judgmental and considerate as possible. Always thinking, I don't know the full picture, you know? Okay. Here's Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava. He's said to have been born from a lotus, like an enlightened cabbage patch. a lotus cabbage patch. I think it's very, very beautiful. I think this picture and the colors are very beautiful. So Urgyan, this is in the first line, is a portion of northwest India that they think is in Pakistan. Where a lot of teachers, well, where Padmasambhava came from, and it was called the land of the Dakinis, because there was a ton of highly realized babes teaching the Dharma that all the men came to study with. So Urgyan, sounds like Oregon, refers to Odiana, which is the land of the Dakinis. Hung, on the northwest border of the country of Urgyan, in the pollen heart of a lotus, you attained marvelous, most excellent city. Renowned as the lotus born, you are surrounded by a vast retinue of Dakinis. As I practice, following in your footsteps, I pray, please confer your blessings. And then this one gives an abbreviated form of the mantra. Guru Pema Siddhi Hung. Guru Pema Siddhi Hung. Guru Pema Siddhi Hung. So I'll read it again. But notice there's the same thing here that we talked about with Tara that we're seeing in the tantras, which is this opening up. Please bless me. Please come help me, right? We're starting to shed the arrogance of I can do it all myself, but also the misconception that we exist separately. Hung, on the northwest border of the country of Urgyan, in the pollen heart of a lotus, you attained marvelous, most excellent city. Renowned as the lotus born, you are surrounded by a vast retinue of Dakinis. As I practice, following in your footsteps, I pray, please come confer your blessings. Guru Pema Siddhi Hung, Guru Pema Siddhi Hung, Guru Pema Siddhi Hung. So in the way that Om Mani Padme Hum and Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Soha are evoking compassion. Om Benza Guru Pamasiddhi Hum is to clear obstacles. There's a force to it. It has a dispelling quality. The mantras and the sadhanas and the yidams, these specific Buddhas, they have these specific qualities, these characteristics. And this one is dispelling. There's a force to it, right? You're going to have obstacles in your life. When you need something to, this is a good one. And I think it'd be nice to support the lamas who are praying fervently starting in this year to avert a prophesied disaster on a global scale, prophesied for 2030. And as part of this prophecy, it's a long one. There's a bunch of other ones that already happened. This is just one list of a prophecy from the 8th century. But things can change. It's not predetermined, right? We just have to put our love and heart into it. So there's many ways, and man, we'll see how it goes. I'm leaving on Friday morning to go to Costa Rica to lead another retreat, so I don't have a ton of time. But in my mind, the resources I want to give you is like this. I can link to the talk, a couple talks on this prophecy, but there's many ways, many practices you can do. But as I said, one is saying this mantra with the wish. May there be world peace, kind of. May nothing bad happen. You hold that wish in your mind as you say the mantra. But guess what? You can also hold that wish in your mind and put the mantra on in your car. Right? There's still benefit. Now, if you're driving along in your car and you're also singing the mantra with it, best. Right? If you're driving along in your car, the mantra's playing and you're thinking other stuff, not as good, but still good. Still better than jamming out to Taylor Swift. Right? Not that there's anything wrong with jamming out to Taylor Swift. But you see what I mean, right? And by the way, if you're like, I'm not feeling the mantra so much, I need me some Taylor. I've never listened to a Taylor Swift song in my life. But I'm going to. It's on my list. I mean, I hear she's great, right? If you switch, you go to Taylor Swift, I go to Outkast, whatever you go to, you keep the wish. May this be of benefit. May this bring pleasure to beings. May this purify beings' minds, right? So you start to bring everything into the path like that. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to play this mantra just once through. It's Deva Pramel, so you can sing it. We can sing it together. And then we're going to, what verses of the Shanti Deva is in this repertoire?
I think the third verse, the one you read today, all of that was.
All of that? How long is it? How long is the song?
It's probably 4 minutes, 3 minutes.
Okay. So then, you're gonna inspire us with a musical version of Shanti.
A little crew that's familiar.
We're gonna have an ensemble. Also, I'll tell you something funny. When I had Neil ring the bell to come back to do for everyone to come back in, I went outside for a second, and I was setting my intention, and then I heard this beautiful chanting, and I was like, oh my God, the Buddhas are singing to me. This is amazing. And then I was like, oh. So we're going to be blessed with that. And then I'm going to read just like three verses or so from the dedication chapter of Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And that'll be our way of dedicating the merit of our time together, like that. Yeah? Okay. So Deva Pramel, by the way, this is so arrogant. I'll share it with you. Like 10 years ago or something, when I was studying yoga, I've discovered Deva Pramel. She does a lot of Sanskrit chants. And the music's a little new agey. And I kind of wrote it off. I was like, oh, she's just like some lady singing Sanskrit. I come to find out she's deeply studied, deeply holds all the transmission for all of these mantras. Incredible, like these super high lamas have gone to her and been like, will you make songs of this? And then I find out my teacher's like super good friends with her and hangs out with her all the time. And so like we get like little concerts with her and stuff. But anyway, I just wanted to like, I didn't know what I was doing. I made a judgment about her, you know? Oh, I lost it, sorry. So she's not just a singer, right? This is a real practitioner with transmission. This is what I listened to on the way here to clear obstacles for this retreat. Neil, when you pop up and tell Stephanie, we'll probably go 5 minutes over.
Oh, my, oh, 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 oh,
action. This is it. Feel it. Make the wish to bring peace, to bring benefit. And then always remember that all the techniques, but especially the tantric techniques, rest on the foundation of compassion. So with that, we invite our friends to sing some Shanti Deva, and then we'll close with a dedication verse. Neil, will you film them with the harmonium? I love me a harmonium. Thank you.
If you have a harmonium,
and you're like,
I can play it. And I'm like, oh, I do.
You're like, well, I do have a harmonium. Would we like to continue the recording? I mean, yeah.
If anybody does like this song from Big Bow, please join us. You can like come up here.
Dance if you feel inspired to dance. Dakini's dance, by the way. That's their thing, they dance, right? So whether or not we're dancing, imagine all the Dakinis around here. They're coming, it's like we've just called them. They're coming, they're dancing, they're throwing flowers, they are blissing out, they think we are so fun and cool.
Thank you. Out across the water, may I become doctor, nurse, and medicine for sick beings in the world. May food and drink descend, ending thirst and hunger. May I be the nourishment they need until everyone is healed. May I provide for the lost and destitute everything they need through the night to guide them. May this very life that I've received liberate the world. May even acts of harm help the violent awaken. May they all come to know each and every joy. Until free from pain, may I be life for all beings throughout the ends of space. Everything I've gained, I joyfully surrender. Every step I take, I'm moving with. May we all come to know the promise of this life, just as all Buddhas embraced the awakened mind, just as they embodied all Bodhisattva practices. For the sake of all, I do adopt the spirit of enlightenment and will follow the way of the Bodhisattva.
That was so beautiful.
Can you give me those verses, and that's what I'll read as our dedication? Can I see those verses, and I'll read from that one for our dedication? Because I heard the verse I wanted to share in there. Thank you. This is so tantric, by the way. It really is. It's really, really fun. I did a little posture behind them. That's the Dakini posture. It's the dancing posture of a Dakini. Okay, so take a second. This is very serious. We did a really cool thing and a good job. It was supposed to be fun. We did a great job. This is awesome. We purified so much. We collected so much good karma. We planted the seeds to be together and for generosity and for all this to keep going in these new and old and creative ways. And we really showed up for each other. And you all really showed up. So touching. And we make the wish. May this merit not stay within us as individuals. May it not stay in this room, but may it extend to the limits of space. Space has no limits, by the way. May it benefit every being. May it bring us all to the highest experience of happiness, bliss, and wisdom. I rejoice in the virtue of all beings. To help attain the way, I offer any virtue that I have. May the pain of every living creature be completely cleared away. May I support the life of boundless untold beings, just as the earth does, enduring as space itself. May I be a bridge, a boat, a ship for all to cross the water.
May I become a doctor, nurse, and medicine for sick beings in the world. May food and drink descend, ending thirst and hunger. May I be the nourishment they need until everyone is healed. May I provide for the lost and destitute everything they need through the night to guide them. May this very life that I've received liberate the world. May even acts of harm help the violent awaken. May they all come to know each and every joy. Until free from pain, may I be the life for all beings throughout the ends of space. Everything I've gained in this retreat, I joyfully surrender. Every step I take, I'm moving with the world. May we all come to know the promise of this life. Just as all the Buddhas embraced the awakened mind, just as they embodied all Bodhisattva practices, for the sake of all, I do adopt the spirit of enlightenment, and I will follow the way of the Bodhisattva. Emaho. Emaho! Good. Thank you all so much. Super fun, super wonderful. I'm going to pass this over to Aaron or Stephanie, and then I'm going to see you all back for a picture, and then you're all going to fill out those surveys. I hope. Probably right out front. We're going to talk, and you're going to go right into a picture, and I'm going to see you out in picture land. You can probably stop this. Sorry for running late. I hope this singing inspired you.